I thought of maybe introducing a little bit the general trend of the work that we do by this introductory foil, and then I'll come to the high PC materials. In studying the solid state in general, there are several approaches that people take, and what one wants to know, in fact, is the microscopic interaction that determine the properties that these materials have. And you can take several approaches. You can take the solid and throw various fields at it, temperature, pressure, radiation, and see how that solid reacts at different length scales, probing the interactions at the different length scales. That's one particular thing that you can do. Alternatively, you can play around with the chemistry. You can substitute some of the elements, playing around with the ionic radius, playing around with the valences, try to influence the properties and the microscopic interactions in the solid in that way. And when people do that, typically they assume that they are working, or they try to work at a constant structural, at a constant space group. And this is a variable, or this is a quantity that people in general have not tried to modify substantially. Now, in films, one of the things that you can do is you can try to make films which reproduce the properties of the bulk. That's what a lot of people do. You can also try to make films which have properties that are very different from the bulk. And the idea is that we try to modify the symmetry or the space group of the materials, strain them slightly, strain them more and more, and see how the microscopic interactions change while we do that. Hoping, for instance, to figure out which structural quantities in the high-TC superconductors are essential for the mechanism and which not. I mean, that's kind of the general approach that we try to take for many of the oxides that we study. Okay, so the work on superconductivity is the result of an ongoing collaboration since many years with Martinoli, Triscone, and Fischer. Both in Switzerland, we have a joint research program with the Swiss National Science Foundation since about 7 years on the cuprates. And as already mentioned, the question that I'd like to address today is to figure out if there is such a thing like a critical structural parameter that will allow me to change the phase diagram of a cuprate in the following way. I plot here TC, that's for the 214 compound, as a function of the strontium content, and the black dot is what you see, is the bulk phase diagram. And the question I have is there a structural parameter that allows me to tune TC up or down by a factor of 2, and I've just multiplied by 2 or divided by 2. But that's really the question that I would like to address. Is there such a structural parameter? And if there is, what is it? And the candidates for such a quantity have been cited by many people in the literature. One can think of the distance between the copper oxide planes being one. One can think of the thickness of the charge reservoir. That's what some people claim. The buckling angle can be such a parameter. The distance in the plane could be such a parameter. Or finally, the charge transfer distance could be the parameter. And one can, by looking at the various compounds and the structure of the various compounds, one can kind of exclude some of these already a priori. And if you, for instance, look at the interlayer distance, you will find that distance does not correlate at all with TC in the various compounds. And the same is true for the thickness of the charge reservoir. So those you can kind of exclude already a priori. And what is left is the buckling angle, the in-plane lattice parameter, and the charge transfer distance. And there are many ways to attack this problem. You can look at it by comparing different compounds. You can apply hydrostatic or uniaxial pressure, or you can play with the epitaxial strain. And many people have tried to attack this problem by comparing different compounds, Jorgensen, Edwards, Rao, or by playing around with hydrostatic pressure. If you play with hydrostatic pressure, you are also changing the volume of the material, and when you do that, you change also the effective doping. the advantage of using epitaxial strain is essentially we try to work within the elastic boundaries, and when we do that, we basically keep the volume more or less constant. So it's a little bit a different approach. And the hydrostatic pressure coefficients for all the hydro-C compounds have been measured, and they are listed here. Typical values are between 1 and 2 Kelvin per gigapascal. And if you apply hydrostatic pressure on a compound, you apply that pressure isotropically in all three directions. But since the materials are layered, it makes sense to decompose that effect in an in-plane contribution, applying pressure in the plane, and an out-of-plane contribution because of the anisotropic nature of the structure. And if you know the elastic coefficients of the material, Young's modulus, Poisson's ratio, you can then connect the amount of pressure that you apply with the amount of lattice deformation that you're going to induce, and that connects this relation. Then with this relation, while I describe the change of TC, or I decompose it in two parts, the in-plane strain and the out-of-plane strain. And that is the two coefficients we're going to play with. And these parameters have been derived in the literature. The in-plane change of TC for stress, this value, the out-of-plane, this value. You can put in these two numbers in that equation and make a contour plot, which is like a prediction, and you see that depending on the amount of strain along the C-axis or the AB plane, you can increase TC for about 2% up to maybe 50 Kelvin for the 214 compound. I mean, this is just a prediction. But you can also bring it completely down to zero just by playing with that strain parameter. Sorry. Yeah, I'm standing in the way. Okay. Yeah, okay. 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 Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What? Should I? Okay. So we take this equation. And these two quantities have been measured. Yeah. But these are the two experimental parameters that we have, the strain. Right. So we put these in this contour plot. Yeah. And then we have equi-strain lines. This is minus 5 Kelvin, plus 5 Kelvin, plus 15, plus 25, plus 35, depending on the amount of strain, just simply using that equation. But it's a very simple prediction. Whether you can then synthesize materials under those conditions is a different problem. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you
compress
in the layer,
TC goes up. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. One is going up, and the other one is coming down.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So if you compress in the plane, TC goes up.
Compress
in the plane, TC goes up.
Getting smaller in
yes.
The plane.
Yes. Yes. TC goes up. Yeah.
Through the layer.
Yeah, that's right.
So
for the, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what these two measured quantities suggest for that compound.
Is this true from material to material?
Well, Anderson has a problem with these data, I know.
For this material?
Yeah.
Or
what?
For this material or for
The problem to make measurements like that, uniaxial pressure measurements like that, and that's what you need to do if you want to derive this quantity experimentally. You need to have relatively large single crystals, and so you can have them for the 1-3 compounds. But in the 1-3 compounds, because of the chain, this relation is completely different because the chain is very sensitive. Okay, I would claim that the tendency for all materials is exactly like that. And I'll come to that also later in the talk. But I would say, for the mercury compound, people have not been able to measure uniaxial pressure dependence. For the thallium compound, people have not been able to measure uniaxial pressure dependence.
These data for 214?
These are 214, yeah. These data for 214. These data for 214, and that's just putting these numbers into that equation. Okay. And it's yeah. It's a two-layer system, and, okay, I don't know.
To make comment, 4YDPO, results from, I think, three different groups, from what I see, is that if the pressure on the chain, perpendicular B, keeps you going up for the tone, and the pressure perpendicular A, keeps you going down for the tone, and the pressure on C, keeps you going up for the tone.
It's not quite like that. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Have they increased or something to say it's looking important?
No.
No.
Yes.
Going closer to the side now. Okay.
I mean, these two values have been predicted, have been measured experimentally, and from that you can also predict the hydrostatic response. And from these numbers you would just believe that as I apply hydrostatic pressure that TC goes down, but that is not in agreement with what people measure. So connecting these two things is not necessarily something that is completely coherent. So it's just a prediction, and then we'll see with our experiments how far we can get. And I think that the reason why this is not coherent is because in one experiment I keep the volume constant, in the other I don't keep the volume constant. And that is something that's... What is the difference between these two sets of experiments? Uniaxial and... Okay, so our method to induce this pressure is basically the choice of the substrate. And for the system I'll discuss mostly, this is this 2-1-4 compound with 0.1 strontium doping. We use a substrate to induce compressive strain. So we are compressing the 2-1-4 film that is on strontium lanthanum aluminate with this lattice parameter. And you see that's only a small change in lattice parameter between these two materials. So it's a relatively small amount of compressive strain, maybe of the order of 0.6%. To do the opposite, tensile strain, we use strontium titanate, and that's a very big lattice parameter compared to that. So in principle, we can apply much more tensile strain in that system. Okay. Just one word about how we grow these films. We grow these films using a molecular beam epitaxy system, where we deposit the lanthanum and the copper and the strontium separately. We don't do co-deposition, and we actually make a sequence in which we deposit two monolayers of lanthanum and then one monolayer of copper on top. And what happens, the chemistry that happens, is that the copper diffuses in between the two lanthanum layers. So I end up with a sequence lanthanum, copper, lanthanum. And the reason why we do that is every time you try to stabilize or you force the structure so that it has to stabilize the copper oxide plane on the surface, that's an unstable state and that gives rise to precipitation. So that's what we use this, we call this block by block method. Is not a very good acronym, but it's in contrast to the layer by layer growth. When you do that, when you simply try to follow the structural arrangement, you try to force the copper O2 plane stable on the surface, and that's not a stable state. So it's not good to grow these cuprates in a layer by layer form. Yes, there is a reason. Yeah, I come to that. Yes, yeah, I'm coming to that. Yeah. I'm coming to that. Yeah. So, after many years of working on that system, we've grown 2-1-4 film since 92. That's when we started. We were able to control the growth and the strain to a significant amount, and that's finally the result that we got. Again, 0.1, this is the resistivity versus temperature curve for a bulk sample. This is the sample grown at this. These are two samples which are grown at the same time. So we can put them next to each other in the growth chamber. We grow them at the same time, so they have the same temperature, same composition, exposed to the same amount of oxygen pressure. Everything's the same. So on strontium titanate, we have a TC0 of about 10 Kelvin. And on the other substrate, we have a TC of about 50 Kelvin, 49 Kelvin. Okay. This is compressive strain in the plane, with as a result, the C-axis becomes longer. This is tensile strain in the plane, and as a result, the C-axis becomes shorter. Okay, and the reason, basically, why this works is because the quality of the interface and the film in general is very good. And this is a TEM picture that illustrates that. The white dots that you see in the film and in the substrate are respectively the aluminium columns or the copper columns. And you see that you have them nicely stacked in the substrate, more or less as nicely stacked in the film. It's not really perfect. But what is very interesting is that if you look at that stacking, I have here, let's start from here, I have copper, lanthanum, lanthanum, copper, lanthanum, lanthanum, copper, lanthanum, lanthanum, copper, and then here, lanthanum, copper. So at the interface, there is one lanthanum oxide which is missing. And that's a very interesting growth mechanism, because what it gives us, if you look at the step, for instance, you can follow this step here. There is a step in the substrate here. But despite this step, the first unit cell grows completely without problem over that step. And in most other thin film systems, that's where defects appear, and that's where you lose a lot of the strain that you try to impose. So that's one of the reasons why this works well in this particular case. Okay. So once we've done that, the next question is then, how can we look at how the atoms in the unit cell move when we do such an experiment? And that's a little bit a tricky question, because with the amount of material that we have, this is about 150 angstrom to 1-4, you cannot go to a neutron diffraction facility to ask them to do neutron measurement. So what we try to do is we try to record X-ray data, and this here is a theta to theta intensity spectrum measured along the C-axis. So we see all the 0, 0, 4, 6, 8 peaks. And because the film is very smooth, you see also around each of these peaks, you see these so-called finite size oscillations around each of these. So we have, in fact, a lot of intensity, a lot of peaks around each of the main peaks. And these oscillations are just due to the fact that the films are very smooth. So you have an additional interference maxima that appear if you can do that. And so we try then to define that spectrum using the main interatomic distances in the unit cell, and this is the result of the refinement, to compare that with Reed filter refinement that people typically do. I would say we have an R value, which is a goodness of fit value of about 1.5 to 2%. Okay, but we only refine the structure along the C-axis. We don't know exactly what happens in the plane. Okay. 100 to 250. 100 to 150, depending on. In this case, it's 150.
How many units?
12. 12 units. Yeah, that's what it's. Yeah, if we grow them thicker, they start to relax more and more. Yeah. Okay, so from that analysis, we can look at easily look at the positions of the lanthanum and the copper in the unit cell. We also try to refine the oxygen positions, which is a little bit delicate. But since there is no X-ray refinement person in the audience, I guess I can talk about that without being shut down. So we try to refine the positions of the oxygen also, and we have to take it with a grain of salt, but we have additional evidence that support that. So what the main result is that in both cases, for the films under tensile and compressive strain, is that we refine it in such a way that we find that the copper oxide planes in both cases are completely flat. These are measurements at room temperature, which means that in both cases there is no buckling. Okay. That for that statement we need, in this experiment, we need to refine the oxygen position that's, as mentioned before, that's delicate. We have additional evidence for that is if there is a buckling in these materials, the structure will either be orthorhombic or it will be this low temperature tetragonal phase. In both of those cases, you see that in TEM data, in the TEM diffraction, you easily pick up additional reflections. The low temperature tetragonal phase has a superstructure reflection that you can easily see, and the same is true. So if you have a buckling that translates into these two phases, you would see that. We don't see that. And there is also, in the epitaxy, when you grow it in film, you can, up to a certain thickness, you can really also impose the symmetry of the substrate. And in these two substrates that we use, the symmetry is really a square, and in the substrate there is no buckling. So we have good reasons to believe that we can actually keep this, in these two cases, we can keep the planes flat. And, yeah.
So if you look at understand how they're idiotic, but there are mm-hmm. people saying that in normal dose 4,
mm-hmm.
at lower doses, and it's normally LPO, it could be disordered LPC type of thing.
Yeah,
so
yes.
Can you really exclude
that? Well, because we have, we look quite carefully at the TEM data and at the diffraction pattern that on a local scale, I think we can exclude it pretty well. Yeah. Of course, it's room temperature data. We don't know what happens at lower temperature, but the epitaxy in this particular case is quite strong, and the 214 lattice, from that point of view, you can say is kind of a soft lattice. We grow many other oxides, and some are also orthorhombic. I mean, this material, 0.1, is orthorhombic at room temperature. So we grow other materials which are orthorhombic, slightly, very slightly orthorhombic. You grow them on a substrate which is lattice matched, well, they'll tend to keep orthorhombic. You cannot get them tetragonal. Other materials which are much stiffer. But in this case, the 214 lattice is relatively soft, and it adapts to the substrate, and I believe it makes sense that to also expect that at low temperature they remain flat, the copper oxide can remain flat. So we think buckling does not play a big role in here. Okay, then the next thing is to look at how the out-of-plane distances change systematically and compare that with what people have measured in the bulk. And what is shown here are the apical distances. This is this set of data and the in-plane copper oxide distances. And the red dots are for bulk materials, and in this plot I've only taken data from the one-layer compounds at optimal TC. So that's the disco, one layer, 214, the thallium 1, one layer, the thallium 2, one layer, and the mercury compound. And you can look at the apical oxygen distance, and you find that in all these compounds there is quite a clear correlation in that direction. You can look at the in-plane lattice parameters, and you also find that in that particular, that as TC increases for these compounds, that the in-plane lattice parameters increases. And this basically just reflects the fact that as I go up in that series, I use atoms which are bigger and bigger, and that translates in a bigger overall volume of the unit cell, you can say. So the in-plane lattice parameter and the out-of-plane lattice parameter change, but the out-of-plane copper oxygen apical distance changes much more. Okay, now if you look at our thin films, we have a different trend for the in-plane lattice parameter. Clearly, we compress our film, and PC goes up. So if I have to decide which one of these two, the in-plane or the out-of-plane lattice parameter, really reflects the behavior of TC, then it has to be true for the films and the bulk. Then I would say that it's really the out-of-plane distance which controls the value of TC, not the in-plane distance.
Right.
Because the in-plane lattice parameter, our results are completely in disagreement with the trend in the bulk. Okay, you can say it's a small trend. It's true. This line is almost flat. There is quite little change here. And because there is so little change here, I would say it's another argument to think that this is not the main trend. This is all optimally doped samples. And as you change the doping in this compound, the lattice parameters move a little bit around. But from family to family, there are big jumps. So we set out to find a parameter, a structural parameter, that allows us to change TC, keeping the rest of the structure, the rest of the chemistry the same. And, okay, we believe that's the one, yeah.
2.4 to 2.8 is really a lot big.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is a little bit confusing in the sense that if I want to do this analogy, I have to really look also at the other perpendicular distances. And the way to do that is to look at what other people have talked about is to look at these bond valence sums. And that's this is just a quantity which looks at the in-plane and out-of-plane distances, but not just the copper oxygen apical distance, also at the lanthanum oxygen distances in the plane. So I'm now, by making this sum, which is also just a structural argument, I see that as TC increases, for the bulk compounds, which are shown here, it's the whole plane which is decoupling slowly from the copper oxide plane. And if I go back to this plot here, this evolution with the copper oxide apical distance is in fact so is very large, but it is kind of compensated by the mercury atom, which is sitting closer to the plane in that structure. Or the thallium atom is sitting closer to the plane. So but in general, that whole charge reservoir moves up a bit as TC increases in these compounds, in all these compounds.
What do you know about the stoichiometry?
Of our film?
Yeah.
Are you? the deposit material is identical. So the amount of lanthanum, the amount of strontium, the amount of copper for the two films is the same. Whether that is exactly the 2-1-4 composition that you would expect, we don't know that better than 5%. Okay. The oxygen content, I'll also come to that in a second. And there has been a lot of controversy about these results, because you can also increase TC in this compound by just adding additional oxygen.
But not the oxygen.
That's right. 242. Yeah. You are correct. Now we can exclude that for two reasons. If you have a lot of oxygen, you see additional reflections. This gives rise also to a superstructure. It's very easy to pick up, and we've done a lot of work on that in previous years. So we can identify features, both in the X-rays and in the TEM data, for additional oxygen. But we have another argument, and maybe I can just bring it right now. Okay. No. The reason why we can exclude that is by, in fact, looking by repeating that experiment for different strontium contents. If what we do is interstitial oxygen, then independent of the amount of strontium, we should always have the same TC. Right? In fact, interstitial oxygen works very well for X equals zero. You can easily introduce interstitial oxygen, and you can get to 42 Kelvin. Then as you put in more and more strontium, TC slowly goes down. So maybe you have 42 Kelvin in that case for strontium equals zero. And as you put more and more strontium in, keeping the same additional interstitial oxygen, this slowly goes down like that. Okay? Up to about maybe 40 Kelvin for optimally doped. So if we would have that in our phase diagram here, we would also, in this region, particularly in this region, we would still have superconducting films. But we don't. For both films, under compressive strain or tensile strain, once we go beyond 0.05 or 0.04, our films are not superconducting. If we had interstitial oxygen during our growth process, these should be superconducting, and they are not. They're absolutely not. So I think we grow all these samples in the same under the same conditions. If we had a lot of interstitial oxygen, these materials should be superconducting, and I think that really rules it out, that there is some minor quantity. Okay, we cannot rule out, but I would say it's certainly smaller than 0.01, I would say. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. These are the films under compressive strain. Is this set of data? Okay. I'll just come. Okay. In this graph also illustrates why it is so interesting for us to work at 0.01. What is plotted here is the strain that the substrate induces on the film as a function of the strontium content. And as I put in more strontium, the 2-1-4 lattice gets smaller and smaller, and so I am left with less and less strain to play with. So that's why the effect at optimal doping or here becomes smaller and smaller, basically. So we have to, if you want to do it at optimal doping, we have to engineer a new substrate. That's the reason.
Yep.
Is also a possibility. That we cannot exclude. Yeah. Okay, so to finish the structural work or the structural implications, I think we would exclude the buckling angle. We would exclude the in-plane lattice parameters controlling TC. And the main one that is left, I would say, is the charge transfer distance, if you can call it like that. And that brings us experimentally, that gives us some ideas how we can try to increase TC, maybe even playing with more strain, try to change the charge reservoir, try to change these layers, trying to play exactly with that distance. And if you look at Sorry?
What do you call this as transient distance? Because
yeah, okay.
It's just optical oxygen or copper.
It's
transient distance is really that between the next layer and
charge transfer distance would be between one copper oxide plane and the next?
No.
That would be charge transfer?
No. You are saying that the charge transfer distance, because transium is in between, the same.
Yeah.
So what is actually changing is the copper oxygen distance.
The copper oxygen distance and the oxygen lanthanum or strontium distance. I mean, it's the whole charge reservoir in that series of one layer compounds that is slowly decoupling as TC increases. Is slowly getting separated.
I guess the problem is that that really isn't a charged reservoir anymore, in the sense that, that the valencies of all those ions and those radiant layers are basically fixed, right? It's not like in the 1-3 where you really have to change the charged reservoir, and in which you have transfer from the tank to the plant.
Okay.
Here, strontium is 2+, lanthanum 3+.
Yes. Okay.
Although the H2O oxygen, what seems to be happening, you're saying, is that you don't want that H2O oxygen. That's the way you would get a higher C, right?
Okay. Push it up at the affinity. Yeah.
Also think of the distance. I mean, some kind of potential acting on the copper oxide plane from the dopants. That distance is going to determine how strong that potential is. That could be going to be.
Yeah, well, there's the problem of purity potential, first of all, because of the lanthanum strontium fluctuations, charge fluctuations in that plane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the covalency, shall we say, would be the apex oxygen of the copper, because apparently you want to increase, I would say.
Yeah.
The actual other, the reason that stuff goes in that way, I would say, is simply because it's like a layer structure. You know, the copper whole two planes are 2-.
Mm-hmm.
In order to stabilize that, you want a 1+ on both sides.
Yep.
And that's why you get 2-, 1+, 1+, 2-, and so on.
Yep. Okay.
Right?
I mean, if you look at all the perovskite oxides in general, I mean, over the periodic system, you find that the cuprates are the only materials that have such large apical distances. I mean, the nickel, any other
is that because of internal nature of copper? So prefer to have the western moon. But on the other hand, the western is also, I don't know whether they survive, but if you play sometimes in which you don't have any ethical oxygen at all, they are not much better.
No, well, that's why I mentioned this point.
I think it's not just the oxygen. It's really, well, in this picture is the full charge reservoir, if I can call it like that. That is really decoupling. It's not just the oxygen, I think.
But can you eliminate the possibility that the number of carriers in the plane changes?
I'll just come to that in a second. And I just want to finish this point. If you look at all other compounds, if you look at this copper oxygen distance or any similar distance, you find that these distances are much smaller in any other oxide compound. And there's one exception, and that's the lead bismuthate, which is superconducting at 30 Kelvin, which has on this scale 2.15. But the nickelates, for instance, are already much lower. And any other perovskite tends to have an apical oxygen distance, which is very similar like these in-plane distances. And so, so what this also says is that as I move the charge reservoir up from the copper oxide plane, that bonding becomes weaker, and this is reflected also in for instance, in low energy vibrations of the apical oxygen. If you look at the Raman data, you find that in that same series, as you go from here to here, these frequencies become softer and softer.
As you go.
Yeah. This is.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's three-dimensional. Yeah, you're right. It's more or less cubic. Good. Okay. I mean, you're good. The good point. But the distances in general. You're right. Yeah. It's a good point. Good remark. Yeah. But the only ones in which the distances are so large. Lead and bismuth are about the biggest atoms. Okay.
I mean, another question. Probably the most resource you can have is that it's all about when you make yourself. This order has
Okay.
They would expect the system would have this residual resistivity on it. It's when you increase the over.
Yes, it does. It does, and that's also something I wanted to come to. And just show you this data. This is the resistivity. Right, so this is the bulk. This is the resistivity of that film. Okay, and then can maybe jump.
Is it already big in the
what?
Even the first one is believable.
Yeah. Sure.
And this also looks like a typical effect of this sort of higher delta.
Yeah. Effect. Yeah, exactly. I'm moving the planes apart. Exactly. That's what.
And therefore, the resistivity would show no upturn anymore at low temperatures because of some possible Anderson localization, whatever.
Okay, so not lose thread here. Okay. Now, it's a very good connection that you make, because the next experiment that we did, and these are again two samples grown at the same time, but a different run. We have again a sample in tensile strain. We have a sample under compressive strain. It's again 0.1 strontium content, and you also see that the experiment absence is not completely reproducible within a few Kelvin. But what is interesting is that we've plotted here also the carrier concentration derived from the Hall effect. And so, at room temperature. And so I would like to ask you, what do you think? What do you think? The films with the higher TC, do they have a higher carrier concentration or not?
You don't want me to answer.
I don't want you to answer it. What do you think?
Take a vote.
Yeah.
In the central there you have pushed the diatomes to zero. Then it goes to zero.
Oh, it does not go to zero. But what we find is, okay, so I should have plotted RH and, okay, but I plotted the carrier density because the RH goes up in that plot. So the films which have the higher TC have a lower carrier density by a factor of 2 compared to the bulk, and those with the lower TC have a factor of 2 higher carrier density. Okay, of course, that can mean that all what we do is changing the Fermi surface, and that is reflected in the Hall coefficient. And that therefore, this has not is not really connected to a carrier density. But yeah, it is.
So
yeah,
don't
sure.
Could be to anybody.
Sure. Yeah.
100 degree Kelvin, you cannot change the
Okay, so Oshida's data for the bulk. I mean, this is at room temperature. This is the bulk carrier density, and if I plot the rest of his data, his curve is like that. For this composition, his curve is like that. The temperature dependence. Okay, but this is when it's in his stripe phase. Yeah. For a one-dimensional system, we don't have that. I think in our data, we don't have really a strong departure from the trend that we have at room temperature. Contrary to Shida's data, I think we should be more careful to look at what happens really at low temperature. But we've just done a couple of points.
Do you have any other evidence for the Hall effect? I mean,
I know.
Both the worst things you could possibly do, because you first have to understand the strong temperature dependence of the Hall effect and the fact that it goes through zero and all this kind of stuff before
use it as a measure of charge of the area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I'm coming here to learn about
it.
Yeah, and exactly.
Well, I would argue that the system itself is completely different from a permanent, a very different rule size, and all of those special completely different things that actually are very different.
Well, in that case,
I mean, if it's four electrons, it's always much
different
else. But
still,
that's what
but still the whole thing changes sign
as a function of doping. Yeah, okay. Okay.
But have you, for example, like yourself, study on the oxygen edge?
No.
So that is very, very sensitive to the double-tailed open concentration. It's very sensitive.
Okay. No, we have not done that. We have not done that.
No. Those are also hard to interpret to get no big tank lines.
No.
The whole concept is curvy on that.
There's a predicate on that. Yes, and then, but if you start with the lanthanum copper O4, and if you look at the lanthanum strontium copper O4, there's no big problem with that data. And if you have changes at this time, I mean, if you had a change of 5% or something like that, that would be difficult. Then you could work on it. If you have a big change, it could be relevant.
But if you only had a factor, or if you only had 10% change in this whole coefficient, that would not be very. But we have a factor between these two samples, a factor of 4.
So if there is a 10% change in the whole concentration, then I'm not making a distinction between possible holes that are not contributing to the conductivity and others that are.
Yeah.
Which one still may be able to do. But at least. The actual whole concentration you can get with some extra absorption on the 1-4 within 10%.
So your general view of this result would be that we are only changing the ferrofluorine, but we're not changing the doping. Certainly not in any way related to that.
Something else that
I mean, it's in general, it's interested in ferrofluorine. Don't get it.
Okay.
It's really
different
stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. 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 Yeah.
I mean, saying that your material by strontium and that they lack oxygen in O4.
Yeah.
0.0.
Yeah.
Then I agree that it's almost impossible that there must be something previous random.
Okay.
Stable.
So the only thing I could think of is which is a very simplistic view. Since we remove the charge reservoir from the plane, we are actually diminishing the charge transfer.
But where then are the electrons going?
Well, okay.
On the plane, then there have to be holes in the charge on that plane, which is very, very strange. So that would then be probably an element also.
In fact, more accurately,
Okay. Okay. Yes. Archer
is
both.
Like carrier density because it's an interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I can maybe just. Archer page goes in both cases like that. So it's one over. It's one over this result that goes like that.
It's a straight line.
Yeah, it's a straight line. It's more or less a straight line. Yeah. It's like Ushida's data at high temperature. The first part of his data, it looks very similar.
Yeah.
In his data, not in our data. I would say that. But the main difference is that for this sample, the slope seems to be quite different than in his case. Our slopes are much larger, than in his case. And so, but since we don't understand the temperature dependence, what?
I mean, so much is clear.
I mean, when you say it doesn't reflect the carrier density, that's why I've made this plot, which you also know, that it's in the 214 system as a function of strontium doping. If you measure the Hall effect and you use the standard relation, then these are the data points that you get.
Because you've chosen one temperature.
at room temperature.
Under compression, then it is different.
The curve will be different, but it's still a monotonic curve.
Sure.
Which means I put in more strontium, I have more carriers. So there is at least that connection. Maybe quantitatively you don't know exactly, but qualitatively this trend follows. And so my question is, in our films, this trend is kind of broken, because we have a higher TC, but the hole tells us we have lower carrier concentration. So is that true, or is that just changing of the Fermi surface? And that's what I would like to know.
Your carrier density there is changing by a factor of 100, yes. While your Rontgen concentration is only changing by 200.
This curve. Okay. I would say in the underdoped range, this blue curve is just saying that every strontium gives one carrier. This is what this blue curve tells. And as you come close to optimum doping and overdoped, you're right. This then goes off. But I think in the underdoped regime, it kind of follows this simple view. Yeah. So I'm still remaining with that question, that how to interpret that.
Okay.
Well, it's certainly a good question. If we want to introduce orthorhombicity, we have to grow very thick films. And then we lose the strain part.
No. There's no back in both
films. Yeah, that's also true. That's also true. Yeah. So the only structural difference is in plane, out of plane lattice parameters. So, and I come to another point that you also mentioned is what happens with the resistivities. And what I look at here in this set of data, I'm sorry for doing this fit so badly. I look at the slope of the resistivity versus temperature. And the original view for all the high TC cuprates was that if you look at the resistivity from room temperature down to zero, they are always a straight line that extrapolates. That's been the typical view. Now, I tried to plot here the slope for the best single crystal data that I found for materials which have the optimum TC. So the best single crystal data, materials which have the optimum TC. And what I find is that, in fact, this slope is gradually changing. So the materials which have the highest TC, they have a larger slope. And in this case, it doesn't extrapolate to zero. It extrapolates to a positive temperature. For this Biscoe compound and the 214 compound, it closely extrapolates to zero or to a negative temperature. And I think this is a true observation, and it's exactly what you say. As you remove the charge reservoir from the plane, you have less scattering, and that is reflected in the temperature-dependent coefficient from the resistivity. Okay, so that's the top data. And our two films kind of follow. Of course, they are. This is a 0.1 doping. Our two films also follow that trend to some extent. Okay. The other curve, which is below this curve here, this is trying to see what happens with rho C as I go through these different compounds, as I change the copper apical oxygen distance. And you would expect that if I decouple the charge reservoir, that rho C should increase as I do that. And it's very hard to compare the data in the literature, because if you want to compare rho Cs, you have to and you want to be sensitive to that distance, you have to make sure that you are looking at the charge reservoir, which is kind of metallic, so that the charge reservoir itself does not have is not insulating. And so I looked at 214 heavily overdoped and the thallium heavily overdoped compound. So they have different copper oxygen apical distances and they have different rho C. And in this data is also the 123 compound, because it has the lowest anisotropy of all the materials. And so you see, you have a kind of an exponential dependence. As you remove the charge reservoir, rho C, as you would expect, goes up. And the amount it goes up between 2.4 and 2.5, which corresponds to our two samples, is about a factor of 2 from this simple exponential fit. Okay. Now, how that is then related to the change of Hall coefficient, I have no idea. But it clearly, if rho C decreases as I go up, as rho C increases as I go up, I would also think that this gives less charge transfer. I'm sorry. I don't know. That may be a very primitive view. OK. Okay, I'd like to conclude here at this point by just putting back all the data we've shown, more or less, and to see where that could take us, making some predictions. This is the equations we had in the beginning, where we changed DC with the strain. You can also do that by applying pressure. And I've looked at all the different compounds in the literature and tried to find these coefficients, the strain dependence of DC or the pressure dependence of DC. And we put in the amount of strain that we have been able to apply in our films, which is about 0.7%. And that corresponds to a pressure of about 5 GPa. And then you can go through all these compounds, take these numbers, and then fill out what DC change you can expect for that amount of strain or that amount of epitaxial pressure. And you see that in many cases you can increase DC except for the 1-2-3 compound. And what is very strange is that for these two different compounds, if these values in the literature, these two values are correct, you would expect very large increases in DC. 100 Kelvin. Okay, I would like to conclude here.
Other changes that haven't been mentioned explicitly.
Okay.
That affects due to the height of the extra oxygen in the lab when it's dropped in.
Okay.
The relative, what's called, well, the relative ED copper minus PP oxygen.
Yeah.
Energy difference.
Okay.
Central to the main model.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the layer-layer interaction goes through the extra oxygen.
Yep. Okay.
In fact, inspired by partly by Nokia's work, I try to look at the effect of this charge trade tendency on the 2-1-4 compounds and other compounds. To me, it looks as if charge trade tendency is a competing instability, which is encouraged in this lanthanum copper oxide compound.
Mm-hmm.
And then pulling the acetyl oxygen or some other disturbance. Once it discourages start state tendency, the DC goes to some kind of intrinsic value. So,
do you have any idea why, you know, I guess I can refer to your neighbor, right? There is a sort of idea that when you do keep trying, the same model is the right sign to frustrate the site tendency and the physical activity. And then there's a story I hear from what's that saying is that when there's copper oxygen, hybridization that it actually creates keep trying when you think about it, right, in the S character. I would have expected that by pulling the oxygen away, that oxygen away, that would actually enhance the type of tendency. Have you any idea why oxygen is, you know, putting it far away?
It's a very complex situation, right? Whenever you have charge localization, right, phenomenon, can pull the lattice in various complicated ways. So it may be counterintuitive. No, I agree with you that pulling the thing. I mean, one way I, for example, when there is compressional strain, then you are pressing off horizontal AD plane, lattice parameter, so smaller than this. Then naturally that pushes the shear upward. And then charges find it, that means somehow the optical oxygen is helping charge localization, not necessarily through T'. T prime is one possibility. There are all kinds of other electrostatic interactions and polarization which could help. So it's very complex. But however, there is a very clear trend as shown by the
experiment. Yeah, no, I think it's like both, right?
Not necessarily through T prime.
I mean, the most simple I can have is if you have this modulation of the business and that the disorder tends to localize cuts. Right? And when you decrease that part of disorder, that the more dynamic order.
What we were looking at, other than what was not what we found, other than that we were controlling the tilt,
then if we go back over to the old things, we know this is a critical tilt angle.
Yeah.
The problem is you immediately tell us all the way in the beginning of your story, which I believe you.
Yeah.
But you don't have tilt from either.
That's a static tilt. It doesn't say anything about what type of dynamic. I would like to come to something that I kind of forgot to mention, and then it comes back to this. In this part of the phase diagram, for films which are on the compressive strain, we have like a very abrupt change. Either we make films which have a TC of 40 Kelvin, or it's zero. We don't understand why there is such an abrupt change at the moment. We have not done our homework to look if the structure is really perfect here also. But it's either zero or 40 Kelvin. And, okay, so coming back to this thing that you don't like, I put it back up. Clearly, if part of what we do is removing carriers, clearly, and this is for a film with the highest TC, as we go now with lower strontium content, at some point we're going to fall below a critical carrier concentration. And it's clear that once you are below that carrier concentration, it cannot be superconducting anymore. And so, I don't really understand the argument, because if I can take an insulator, if I put enough pressure on it, I can make it a metal. So there is kind of a charge transfer that changes the carrier.
What we're saying is that in this case, you really want to use the strontium lanthanum oxide layers as charged reservoirs.
Yeah.
That those layers are going to be metallic if you're going to dope them with detergent, which is different from this stoichiometry. Your strontium will not be 2 plus and your lanthanum will not be 3 plus. Mm-hmm. Those are such stable things. You would require a horrendous amount of pressure and strength in order to change that situation.
How horrendous.
So where do they all go? One possibility is that that not all of them are contributing to the conductivity, that some are trapped.
Okay.
That would go the wrong way around. You're decreasing the disorder, which would mean that you could have more carriers actually present.
What about oxygen?
I asked about the oxygen. He says it's 0.4. That's why at the beginning I asked what's the oxygen for geometry.
We know that this from those experiments, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone might understand that. Mm-hmm. There's this change from the stridus stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I stay in the lower range, that's our diagonal, and are, sort of insulating, right?
Yeah.
And everyone said, we have stripes which are sort of positionality.
Okay.
Right? So we know that there's a strong change going on in the stridus, and everyone finds it. And now when I see your jump, I start to go, actually think this is somehow related to these observations, the precise rates of which I'm about. As if, these stripes are about 5%, they don't care about that for oxygen, they are there, you can get rid of them. So at 6%, these stripes come together supportively are there, and you do simply that for oxygen, you release the supportivity, and apparently, or likely, will increase them into the stuff. The cross correlation is, would it be nice if you look at specials of kind of NMR, but that's probably all very hard.
Yeah. Not on these films.
No. Right. No, the interpretation is that your price which is holding the TC so low.
Yeah.
The most price from the TC goes up.
Yeah.
I was saying that
if you
pick up something in the hall data, if you do that experiment, that
temperatures than the normal system.
Okay.
Because if you really had the stripes and somehow they really were present or not, we know there's the whole data just suggests some strangeness there. And that's
I see.
The
okay.
I can't think of too many measurements that you're capable of making because of the amount of material you have.
At low temperature.
There's this qualitative behavior recorded by
Ushida. Yes. For stripes, it has a particular.
Maybe we don't understand the kind of evidence of striping being there.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that if you could pick that up down in this region, that would give us some indication whether we might see this behavior associated with stripes.
Well, it's kind of film, the two now, then I think that you really could do the X-ray absorption and do it as a function of temperature, do it as a function of strain. It's very easy because for 100 angstroms, it's ideal. Polarization dependent.
But exhaustion that you talk about?
No. The oxygen KS.
Okay.
The oxygen KS data and the colonist L23S.
Okay. If they are trapped around the strontium, not. If they are trapped around the strontium,
and
if they are deep trapped as they move closer, that would be an agreement. That's in disagreement with the data. Okay. It's very metallic. All these samples are very metallic. These ones. I don't have them in mind. Yes, this one is very metallic. I think it starts metallic and it has.
It's actually really impossible to do NMR.
People try to develop techniques for that, but I think it's still a bit far off. Yeah.
Any of the changes that you have you done? Is it possible to do your barium, potassium, and bismuth oxide as we were talking about? Is there any effort in that direction?
No. I think bismuth is a material we don't like to have in our system. Bismuth is not.
Really too bad as we're talking about oxygen. They put the potassium in, but I think they're running at around, I'm not sure, 0.4 or something. A fairly heavy dose of potassium. raise this thing up to around 30.
Yeah.
And the question is always that then, what if you could move near what is, I think, it was a PDW transition? What if you could move near? I think they they could, and when they did, the material did some kind of internal PDW and insulate.
Yeah.
If you could make a small 100 angstrom sample of this stuff, and you could hold it so you didn't get the disproportionation, you could drop that number down from 0.4. I think there's every reason to believe that QT would go up, and I think we just don't know how high. Again, the picture is somehow it's the bismuth and oxygen. I think that there's actually some motion in there, so there's two types of bismuth in this
zone.
For whatever reason. For various reasons. If your substrate that acts to hold that thing, to prevent it, so you could actually move down to a very low dose of this capacity, I think there's every reason to believe that thing is going to be fine. One of the ways
would be
to build
a substrate, but again, if you say one thing that we will try is we'll try the 214 nickelate in the near future. See if we can play with that and maybe make, you know, terms of putting that.
The volume not changing from that constant data.
Because the material responds elastically, basically. But we are not deforming the material plastically. It's an elastic deformation, and Poisson's ratio of this material is about close to 1/3, and so that's why it's basically a constant volume change.
We've had that.
Yeah, it's a small change. It's really a small change in volume.
How do you contrast some of these changes? Changes in manganese, but there also is that. Can you make some comments about this?
We've done a few experiments, but we have not done anything systematic. So we don't have good manganese film so far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We gave up when everybody started to do that. So concentrate on that. But maybe one interesting comment. Oh, maybe I brought this foil board. Maybe not. That's from 80.
How about that?
We are not going to try. Maybe that's Jim Eckstein. He has been growing disco for so many years. Maybe I think he would be the better person to do that. We don't have bismuth. We don't want to have bismuth in our system.
But that would be an agreement with all we know about high pressure data.
That's right.
Yeah. Of course, then when you go up to 200 or 220, you've got a material that has very big economic impact. So cool it with
I mean, the whole challenge is to stabilize, is to make these films under such a large amount of strain. I mean, to keep so much strain in the films is a challenge in itself. And because the disco is a much more complicated lattice, it's not clear that you can keep so much strain in the films.
Can you raise your 100 angstrom film, you grow it and so forth, and now you store it a while, and you bring it out,
It'll hold. The best so far holds a year, and then it slowly starts to... To go down. Because
at 100 angstrom, the penetration depth on this stuff at best is 1500 angstrom or so. And so you don't have a nice microwave substrate. You've got to be able to hold it at a level of at least the penetration depth.
Well, one way of perhaps doing that is to follow them from other materials. Is that, for example, when you grow chromium oxide, which is an MDO, then you can grow at 100 angstrom. Then it starts doing something else. But if you put two monolayers of lithium oxide on top, then it remembers again that it's going on for another
day. That would be perfect.
So that would be
absolutely perfect for the cell
to recall what it's supposed to do.
Okay. Okay.